On a Monday, it is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kedar Tierkent. Glad you could be here. We're checking in on the next generation 911 system rollout in our state and how call center systems will be transformed, allowing 911 operators to receive cell phone texts, videos, seamlessly share data with other systems. Back in 2019, Wisconsin received a $2.9 million federal grant to help call centers buy equipment. The funds needed to be spent by earlier this year. Join in with your questions about 911 capabilities, the rollout, 800-642-1234. Eric Veal is Director of Emergency Communications for Wisconsin. The office is housed under the Department of Military Affairs. Eric, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thank you for having me.
Good morning. It feels like next generation 911 has been on the horizon for years now. Can you walk us through the capabilities first and how it will be different from the current system?
Sure. So the primary differences or benefits of next generation 911 will be enhanced caller location and call routing. So with the new system, they'll have GPS coordinates when you're calling on your cell phone. So public safety answering points or dispatch centers will be able to locate you as well as an Uber driver. The enhanced call routing will make sure that your location is routed to the correct dispatch center. So because we know your precise location, because we're getting those GPS coordinates, we're able to make sure we're getting you to the correct public safety answering point. There will be faster call routing and call delivery. We've heard that in other states where this has been implemented, callers typically calls are being answered almost before it rings.
Hmm.
And then the network is also more resilient and reliable with more built-in redundancies and automatic rerouting of call traffic based upon congestion or availability of a local PSAT.
So just digging a little bit deeper into the system will be faster. Where are we at now in terms of a call getting answered and handled versus what might be possible with more advanced technology?
It's not uncommon if you call 911 now to actually have it ring a couple times. It takes a little bit of time for the current technology to actually receive and process and route the call. So even if a call taker is ready to answer, the system will give you one or two rings before it actually gets to a call taker. That time is greatly reduced with next generation 911.
In what situations will video or text messages be useful for operators in this new system? Walk us through the developments there.
Sure. Well, that is certainly an emerging technology that next generation 911 will support. It is not one of the core services, but it is a service that will ride on the new network. And it is a capability that each community or local public safety answering point will need to determine how and when to roll out. As I'm sure you know, Wisconsin is a home rule state. Dispatch centers and public safety answering points are typically run by local municipalities, cities, villages, and counties. Each one of those have their own emergency services jurisdictions. And if one of them were to implement texting to 911 or the ability to send picture or video messages, that rollout would need to be well coordinated with the local community so that the citizens would know, when that service would become available and how and when to use it. Not to forget that the dispatch center call takers themselves would also have to receive training and protocols on how and when to use that information. So although, we are embarking on our transition to next generation 911 now as a state, by building a network to support it. As PSAPs join, they won't necessarily come online with the ability to receive texts or videos right out of the gate. Does that make sense?
That does make sense. And PSAPs are these dispatch call centers?
Yeah, I was hoping to take a moment to go over acronyms real quick. I'm going to
we might take a day to go over acronyms.
Yeah. Next generation 911 is the technology that we're talking about. Sometimes I'll say next gen 911, or I'll try to avoid saying NG 911. The first step to bringing next generation 911 is to build an emergency services IP network, or ESINet. I'm also going to try to avoid saying ESINet, but that is the digital network that connects dispatch centers to a service provider. What we're building today will primarily run on fiber optic cable. There will be some copper, and there could be some other ancillary means of communication, but it's primarily going to be a fiber network. And then when I say PSAP, that stands for Public Safety Answering Point. And so that's what you think of when you call a 911 center. The call takers are at a PSAP. Okay. People often associate them with dispatch centers. They use the terms synonymously. They are different, however. Not every dispatch center is a PSAP, and not every PSAP is a dispatch center. But I think for the purposes of our call, we can count them as the same thing. And then the final acronym would be GIS, or Geographical Information Systems, which is kind of a digital mapping system. Maps are very important to next-gen 911 because call takers need to be able to locate you. And so the accuracy of those maps is very important between jurisdictions.
I'm going to reintroduce you for a moment here. We're talking with Eric Veal, the Director of Emergency Communications, and looking at technology upgrades to the Emergency Communications 911 system. Perhaps a little bit of an alphabet soup. You can join in with what you want to know about 911, 800-642-1234. Eric, getting back to text messaging, there are already 3,200, more than 3,200 call centers nationwide, the FCC says, that are capable of receiving 911 text messages, and they keep this master Excel chart that was last updated at the end of last month, and it shows who's capable straight across the country. Is Wisconsin behind on implementing this technology?
So I like to say that Wisconsin's rollout places us kind of in the middle of the pack of when compared to the other 50 states in the U.S. We are certainly making great progress with building out the ESINet and connecting dispatch centers. That progress will also continue to text messages and multimedia.
So when can people expect to start using NextGen 911? Where are you in the timeline for the rollout exactly?
We have a contract with AT&T to build the network. We had earlier this year, we had the first public safety answering points that had began to sign on to use the new system. I think currently we're up to 25 PSAPs out of an estimated 120. The next steps are to begin onboarding those public safety answering points. So that's where, we'll come in and work with them so they could ready their back-end equipment room to receive equipment and have the network installed.
Eric Veal, Director of Emergency Communications for the state, the office under the Department of Military Affairs, giving us an update on NextGen 911, the work to bring the technology behind calling 911 up to current standards, especially as people call from cell phones. Join in with your questions on 911 operations, 800-642-1234. There's more State Cap in a moment. Stay with us here in the Ideas Network. You're with us for the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're getting a status update on the work of bringing analog-era 911 call center technology to the digital age, giving potentially life-saving ability for people to send text messages, pictures, videos in an emergency. A report by the Federal Communications Commission at the end of last year says more than 3,000 911 call centers nationwide were capable of receiving text messages by the end of 2020. Joining in the upgrades, 800-642-1234. Eric Veal is Director of Emergency Communications for the state of Wisconsin with us for about 10 more minutes. Let's bring in Michael now in Madison. Hi, Michael. What would you like to ask?
Hello and good morning. So I have a question regarding, so with different municipalities having different kind of technological abilities and financial abilities that they can handle, how can you reliably track someone, say, if I'm in, not to besmirch it, but like if I'm in Green Bay, but I'm registered in Madison and you ping my cell phone and it comes up Madison, how can you like, how reliable is that to, at an instant, find somebody?
Michael, thank you. Eric?
Sure. So on your cell phone, there are GPS information. And when you call 911, that information will be transmitted to your carrier. And that carrier will use that to send to our next generation 911 core. Which will then route to the proper PSAP. There will be fallback. If we are unable to get that GPS data, we can revert back to the legacy method of locating a cellular caller, which is looking at what tower that cell phone caller is actually connecting to. And because we have a physical address for the tower and we know what sector of the tower that's receiving the signal, we can do cellular routing in that way, but that is a little bit less accurate than using the GPS coordinates from the phone itself.
You mentioned you're building this out with AT&T. How closely do you have to work with the other carriers, the other cell phone carriers on this technology?
Very closely. They're all very important partners. Although AT&T is building our network and going to provide the core services, the other carriers still need to provide, get the cell phone and landline traffic to us. So once the ESINet is built and a PSAP has connected to it, that's when AT&T and my office and the local municipality works with the carriers in their jurisdiction to be able to begin migrating their callers onto the new network. And so that's a process that kind of can happen, you know, one at a time until the myriad of carriers in that area are all cut over.
How are smartwatches that can make emergency calls, I wonder, impacting, these PSAPs, the 911 call centers?
You know, that's another emerging technology that NextGen 911 will be able to support. If the smartwatch is able to access a voice communication network and dial 911, then, that will get routed to the PSAP and they will have information to dispatch services to those types of callers as well.
Let's talk about cost. What is the price range for municipalities to get the next gen 911 technology off the ground and working?
So it certainly varies based upon the size of the municipality. But there's really, there's two components. There's many components of costs that the PSAPs have to deal with. But two primary ones would be the cost to join a network. And in this case, the state has provided my office with an appropriation to fund that. So when a municipal PSAP joins our network, we're covering that cost. The other side of that, though, is the call handling equipment that's actually in the dispatch center that's sitting on the table that the call taker actually uses to answer the call and has the screen with the map where the caller, pops up on. That technology is purchased, procured, and owned, maintained by the local PSAP. And that does need to be capable of supporting next generation 911. You mentioned the $2.9 million grant
Yes.
a little while ago.
Mm-hmm.
That grant was primarily utilized by local municipalities to upgrade and make ready their call taking equipment so that they could join an ASINET.
How many municipalities were able to get a piece of that nearly $3 million grant?
I'm going to estimate that about 100 did,
okay.
But I don't have the exact number on the top of my head.
So what other funding abilities do municipalities have to be able to, you know, really get this technology going and to get it online as soon as possible? Where will they look to when they're, you know, when some municipalities have really, really tight budgets and are looking for way, you know, for looking for ways to shed things from their budget, not add?
Mm-hmm. So the state has created two additional grant programs to support the transition to next generation 911. There $6 million annually is available to help support the transition that can be used to purchase call taking equipment. Like we mentioned before, it can be used for training. It could be used for backroom infrastructure like HVAC systems to support the server room. And then there's a second grant program that was recently created that's devoted to helping communities update and ready their GIS data or their mapping data to make sure that it's in the we need all of the mapping data to kind of be in the same format in order to upload it to a central location and make all the maps line up. So there is going to be ongoing support while the state makes this transition.
Eric Veal with us, Director of Emergency Communications Office under the Department of Military Affairs, as we discuss Wisconsin's transition to next-gen 911. Taking your questions along the way, 800-642-1234. Eric, how vulnerable could next-gen 911 be to cyber attacks, to some type of outside attack?
Yeah, so, you know, all computer networks are vulnerable to intrusion or cyber attacks in some way or another. We are lucky that, you know, this is going to be a private network. It's not going to be, directly connected to the internet. That certainly will limit access to it. And then, we're partnering with AT&T that will be managing the security of the network. And we're very confident that we will be able to implement and maintain a secure network to support NG911.
FirstNet is also something I wanted to ask you about, this wireless nationwide network that gives public safety people a dedicated network for communicating. What is FirstNet and how does it roll into next-gen 911 technology?
Yeah, so FirstNet is, as you mentioned, it's a nationwide public safety broadband network. So it's like 4G LTE for police, fire, and EMS that has been built out over the past 7 years now through a federal contract with AT&T FirstNet. And that that network can support next generation 911 networks as part of, backup connectivity. So if a PSAP has, one fiber path into the network and that fiber gets cut and they're in a location where they didn't have access to a second fiber line, they could have a FirstNet router or device there to fall back on. And so they could still receive 911 calls just over the FirstNet network.
Oh, it's almost like a backup or a redundancy as well.
That's correct.
So, as you look at staffing situations in these centers, we've had a lot of issues with, emergency and fire service struggling to maintain staffing. How much is that shortage affecting these 911 call centers and response times?
Staffing has been a problem in dispatch and for many years. It has certainly increased during the Great Resignation and the realignment of the nation's workforce in response to COVID-19. But I do know that, dispatch center directors and PSAP managers are working very hard to recruit and retain people. so that it will have a minimum to no impact on call times.
Eric, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Eric Veal is Director of Emergency Communications for Wisconsin. The office is under the Department of Military Affairs. Just ahead, State Capitol Report continues with a conversation on shared revenue and what local governments are saying about their budget needs related to the portion of state tax revenue that reaches their local coffers. Join in with your take on shared revenue, your local experiences and solutions, 800-642-1234. News update is next. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. On a Monday, it is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Our state is in its strongest financial position in more than 50 years. Revenue Secretary Peter Barca on our state cap last month.
You know, we're in the best shape we've been in fiscally in more than a half century. We've got a huge surplus.
So what does that mean for local governments and shared tax revenue from the state? In recent decades, shared revenue has made up a shrinking portion of local government budgets. Join in on shared revenue, 800-642-1234. Jerry Deshane is Executive Director of the League of Wisconsin Municipalities. Jerry, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Well, thank you, and good Monday morning to you, Kate.
Good morning to you as well. So the League is asking the legislature to increase revenue sharing for cities and villages, calling the current system broken. Why do you see it as broken?
Well, and I heard Peter's comments about the state being in the best fiscal shape it's been in years, and I'm not going to pull a tale of two cities here, but the city of Milwaukee laid off 120 cops 2 years ago. There's a disconnect with how well the state is doing with its budgets and how challenged local governments are doing. And the bottom line, it's because the system we have doesn't work. The system is supposed to share money from the state to local governments. That's just not happening. Hasn't happened for about 30 years. Let me say this, to be clear, it's not keeping up with inflation, nowhere near keeping up with inflation.
When you mentioned Milwaukee's layoffs, that's the largest city in Wisconsin. How are other municipalities doing that are much smaller than Milwaukee?
It frankly is more of the same. Between 2018 2019, and this was, keep in mind, before the whole defund the police rally and cry was out there. During that period of time, 59 of Wisconsin's police departments laid off officers. What's happening out there on the local level is we are cannibalizing local budgets because property taxes aren't keeping up with inflation and shared revenue hasn't gone up in a meaningful way in over 30 years. And those are the two primary ways to pay for local government.
Yes, if you could just step back and explain how local governments in Wisconsin fund services. What does that pie look like?
Well, the biggest piece of the pie is the property tax bill that you pay with your monthly rent check or that you pay once a year on your house. That represents roughly 53% or more. The next biggest piece of the pie is shared revenue. That's about 25% of the total. It's higher in some places, smaller in other places. And then the remaining 25% or so is made up of fees, utility fines, just a kind of a mishmash. You know, your late fee at the library, Kate, although I'm sure you never had any of those. But the real drivers, the real workhorses, if you will, are property taxes and shared revenue. And we have, frankly, the most stringent system in the entire country. Our property taxes are locked down tight. They only go up by the value of new houses that are built in a year in a given community. And as I said several times now, shared revenue, that is the state coming in to share sales and income taxes, hasn't moved in over 30 years. That is a recipe for disaster.
Jerry, what should that pie look like? What do you see in a reform vision for shared revenue?
You know, when you talk to people about your retirement income, what do they tell you? They tell you to diversify. That's what Wisconsin does not do with local government finance. At the state level, you have sales tax, you have income tax, you have corporate taxes. Then you have a variety of federal funds and all of that other thing. In Wisconsin, it's sales and it's property and shared revenue. That's it. We don't really have a sales tax option. There's a small handful of cities and villages that have what's called a premier resort area tax. Counties have a 0.5% sales tax. But if you're, say you live in the, you know, the village of Oregon, if the Oregon Fire Department, Police Department, Public Works Department, if they need more resources to do the job you need them to do, they can go to referendum, but the only thing they can ask the taxpayers for is more property taxes. That's not the way it should be done. There should be more options. You look at other states. Wisconsin has one of the lowest sales taxes in the country. Why isn't a local sales tax option of some form an option here in Wisconsin?
So that would be one way that you could see a positive change on these squeezed local budgets if there was an ability to tax that went directly to local government.
Yes, and a sales tax, you know, I go there only because it's sort of the easiest and most obvious. Mm-hmm. You know, the other option is the state could take a look at shared revenue. And, you know, if you go back in history, I was still around in 1911. That's when the sales tax or the income tax was created.
Mm-hmm.
In 1911, they promised voters in a statewide referendum, if you can imagine that, that 90% of income tax revenue would go back to local governments. It was conceived as a way to fund local government. Today, you're looking at maybe 14% of that. If the legislature and the governor could agree that, you know, we really should be sharing in the true sense of that term, that is another really good option. That's a way of saying, look, we know incomes are generated at the local level. We certainly know that shopping and sales are generated at the local level. We are going to truly share that revenue in a way that keeps step with the economy. We're just simply not doing that now and haven't done that for 30 years.
Talking with Jerry DeShane, Executive Director of the League of Wisconsin Municipalities, as we talk about shared tax revenue and the money that state gives to local governments and the piece of that pie. You can join in with your perspective, 800-642-1234. Jerry, Congress provided like $150 billion for state and tribal and local governments through the CARES Act and the pandemic. Hasn't that helped bolster municipalities with their budgets?
It has certainly helped us do some things. Absolutely. Absolutely. But it's one-time money. Kate, that money will be gone within 3 or 4 years. What we're talking about here is an ongoing and generational problem. The other thing that I want to keep reminding people is the legislature itself, legislative leaders warned us, don't spend that federal money on ongoing programming. Hmm. Well, police, fire, ambulance, public works, libraries, those are ongoing programs. So we're talking about short-term versus long-term here, fixing things the right way rather than putting a Band-Aid on them.
What revenue streams, when you look outside of Wisconsin, do cities in other states have that Wisconsin cities don't have? Who do you look to for some models out there?
Well, and I'm not going to name a specific state as, you know, they are Mecca. They have the perfect solution here because it's different for every state. Depending on the mix of citizens, you have an older population, younger population. Las Vegas, they don't have an income tax because they have so many people coming in and out of their entertainment venues that they raise their revenues that way. Alaska, it's oil revenue. So it varies by state. What I would say, a place like Wisconsin, where we're kind of Midwest average, we're relying too heavily on the property tax. We're not relying hardly at all on the sales tax. I think we ought to take a look at what the income tax does for the state and maybe see if we can do a better job of sharing that locally. Those are probably the major buckets.
Jerry DeShane heads up the League of Wisconsin Municipalities as we discuss the future of shared revenue in our state at a time of flush coffers, skyrocketing inflation. What does that mean to your community? Join in on appropriations for shared revenue and how you see dividing up the state tax collections pie. 800-642-1234. Back in a moment for more State Cap with Jerry DeShane here in the Ideas Network. It's the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're discussing the amount of shared revenue the state distributes to local governments that has remained stagnant over a decade while state tax revenue has climbed. Governor Tony Evers had called for increasing shared revenue in his budget, but told us in February,
"We've had great trouble with the Republicans getting shared revenue increased in the state. That's the money that those municipalities use to do their work, including fire and police protection."
Join in on the largest funding source provided by the state to local municipalities, 800-642-1234. Jerry DeShane leads the League of Wisconsin Municipalities with us for about 12 more minutes. Jerry, you hear the governor there talking about supporting shared revenue increase. What has blocked Republican lawmakers from moving forward with changes?
Well, and first of all, let me say this, two things. First of all, we're very grateful for the governor's support. He did propose a 2%, or I forget if I get the number wrong, but he did support an increase in shared revenue. But this is a bipartisan problem. This has gone back not 10 years, not 20 years. It's gone back 30 years. And you've had Republican and Democratic governors, Republican and democratically led legislators. Kate, the problem is I think we've lost the notion that it's shared revenue. It has become just, you know, one more hand in the state budget every year, even though it truly is a part of, and I would argue probably the most important part of government service in Wisconsin. And we've just sort of kind of forgotten that over the years. And that's really unfortunate. It's ironic. This is EMS week. And here I am, you know, the voice of doom. But EMS is funded locally. 80% of the EMS systems in the state are owned and operated by local governments. And you know, they're hurting. It's a combination of people. But a big problem, a big part of the problem is also money. So I guess, Kate, maybe the mayors have done too good a job. I had a conversation with Jake Woodford, the mayor of Appleton, a couple of weeks ago. And Jake said, you know, we can't continue to shield our citizens from the impact of this. They've been behind the scenes duct taping and bailing wiring the system to keep it working and to keep the obvious pain away from citizens. You know, one way you do that is you put off street repairs for 100 years. But they've been able to do that, but those chickens are coming home now. And the mayor said to me, Appleton just isn't going to be able to shield its citizens from the visible impact of this much longer. You're going to see more Milwaukees where we have to lay off cops, even without cutting their budget. Their PD budget didn't go down. They have 120 fewer officers. So
we have a comment here from Jeff in Delafield, called in and couldn't stay with us. And Jeff says that the current shared revenue system forces smaller municipalities to accept development when they don't want to. Do you understand what Jeff is trying to get at there?
Absolutely. The only way a local government's budget can increase, the only way the tax levy part of their budget can increase, is if they build new development. That's the factor that is new in state law since, oh, about a decade or so. Just before the Great Recession, we had this great idea, let's tie property tax levies to new development. So you can only raise your property tax levy, again, keep in mind, biggest part of your budget, by the amount of new construction. So yes, you are therefore tied to new development. For most communities, Kate, the problem is not that you're tied to new development. It's that there's just not enough new development to keep up with inflation.
You mentioned being around 1911. And, you know, I want to go back to the 1970s, though, when I was alive. And, you know, the U.S. the U.S. had the general revenue sharing program, which federal funds went to state and local governments that could be used at their discretion. That ended during the Reagan years. But there's been this renewed call for this program of general revenue sharing in the pandemic years. And I'm wondering, what do you make of a U.S. fiscal equalization policy today?
Wow, that is beyond my pay grade. First of all, I would hope the U.S. government could pay for it. But I think if I'm in favor of local shared revenue, then federal shared revenue would also be helpful. But again, to me, it's one more piece of evidence that people recognize there is a problem out there, and that we need to take a renewed look. And let's not forget why we send revenues to local governments. There's an ancient principle in representative democracy that says you solve the problem as close to the problem as possible. Mm-hmm. Subsidiarity is the word. What it means is the best government is the one that's closest to the people. Well, in order for that to work, it's a given that government has to be funded in accord with needs. And that's what's missing.
Jerry DeShane with us, Executive Director of the League of Wisconsin Municipalities, as we discuss shared revenue, the status now, and the vision for tomorrow among the municipalities he works with. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Jerry, how does the reliance on property taxes to fund local services, how does that ultimately affect residents of cities?
We're overdoing it. I mean, it's too much of a good thing. The good news about property taxes is they're very stable. When the economy crashes, property taxes tend to stay the same. Mm-hmm. Now, the bad news in that is, Kate, let's say you're the economy and you lose your job. Well, guess what? The city still says, Kate, your property tax bill hasn't changed. Most other taxes ebb and flow with the economy. And to treat citizens fairly, to kind of match where they are at, you need a more diversified system. I'll tell you where this is going to really pinch Wisconsin is the elderly. People living in their homes on fixed incomes, they have a very limited capacity to absorb increasing property taxes. And yet, again, it's EMS week. The number of EMS calls are continuing to go up in Wisconsin as more and more of our population ages in place. So it really compounds the problem to say to my grandmother, my mother, you know, not only is your property tax bill not going to go down, we need to go to referendum because we have to expand the ambulance service. And the state says the only referendum we can have is a property tax referendum. We think there should be other options on the table.
When you talk with lawmakers, what do they tell you in these situations?
I think there's a growing, and I won't say consensus because it's not there yet. I think there's a growing realization that this is a problem that needs to be fixed. Lawmakers, they talk to their first responders back at the local level, and they hear the growing problem. I think we are getting closer to a place where we can fashion a consensus. A Republican-led legislature is going to be very fiscally conservative, and that's a good thing. That's what the public wants. But I would say you can do that and still have a diversified system. I'm hopeful we'll get there this next legislative session. If not then, perhaps within a session and a half. I know a lot of my cities were not happy to hear me say that just now.
Could shared revenue at all be tied to inflation? As inflation soars, so would that piece shared revenue? Or, you know, can you fashion something that would be more connected to the cost of living?
Absolutely. And I don't want to get stuck on any one solution because, as you're pointing out, there are dozens of ways to do this. Income tax in Wisconsin has essentially tripled since 1993. In that same period of time, shared revenue, the money that goes back to first responders, hasn't moved at all. It's been the same amount of money. So tie us to the economy. Yes, please.
We heard from Steve in Madison, called, couldn't stay with us. And Steve wants to see more federal money, more federal help to go toward things like trains and other forms of transportation, and other ways of getting around communities and have those funds come from the federal government. What would you tell Steve?
I would tell Steve that you're seeing a lot of that in the bipartisan infrastructure law. They increased funding for the whole swath of transportation by something like, oh, I'm going to get the number wrong, 25%. It's substantial. But I also want to say the state legislature, Republicans in the legislature, increased transportation funding at the state level. So there is hope on the transportation side, Steve. What we're looking at is the entire other part of the operation of local government, and no help is there yet.
When you say there might be, you know, some good news on the horizon a year and a half down the way, can local governments wait that long? Or are they out of time before they really have to cut into the bone of services?
I think Mayor Cavalier Johnson of Milwaukee is probably going to be on the phone to me this week chastising me. Milwaukee is already cutting. Other cities are already cutting. The pain is already with us. I'm just being a political pragmatist, looking at how long will it take to assemble a legislative consensus. I would be hopeful we could do it in 2023. That's the right answer. Because, you know, unfortunately, as we've seen, there are consequences to these decisions. You know, we saw that in Milwaukee over the weekend. And that's not all about money. There are other factors at play, right? But how you deal with these problems locally has a great deal to do with money.
Jerry, thank you for joining us.
Kate, it was a pleasure, and I hope I didn't run on too long.
No, you did not. Jerry DeShane is Executive Director of the League of Wisconsin Municipalities. Just ahead, we take a hike along Wisconsin's Ice Age Trail with one of its volunteers of 30 years and a thru-hiker who is the subject of a new documentary film. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is a State Capitol Report on The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.